Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, Israel's air and artillery strikes continue to kill dozens more Palestinians in Gaza as the regime's all-out war rages on across the besieged Palestinian territory. At least 25 people have been killed and several others injured in an airstrike on a house in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Three children also lost their lives after Israeli regime bombed the bicycle carrying them in the eastern part of the city. Several areas in Gaza City, as well as Beit Lahia and Rafah, also witnessed fresh Israeli attacks. The airstrikes and artillery fire on Gaza are coupled with a ground invasion. The regime's military says its troops have begun operating in the Shojaiya area in the northern Gaza Strip. The genocidal war on Gaza continues amid the dire situation of health facilities there. The director of the Baptist Hospital says the situation is catastrophic and out of control. Since October 2020, over 50,600 Palestinians have been killed in the genocidal war. For more updates, we're now joined by Moti Abu Mosaber, correspondent, who's with us from Deir al-Balah. Moti, welcome to the program. Please bring us up to speed on the latest situation in Gaza as the Israeli genocidal massacre and this war of extermination continues all across the Strip.
Yes, unfortunately, the massacring of the Palestinian people is still underway and abated, having more Israeli strikes and attacks carried out left and center. And let me begin with the fresh attacks that took place a short while ago in Khan Yunis City after the Israeli fighter drones carried out several attacks targeting the makeshift tents of the Palestinian people in Al-Mawasa area, in addition to the eastern part of Khan Yunis City, claiming the lives of three Palestinian civilians. In the meantime, two Palestinian civilians were also killed after the Israeli fighter drones targeted another makeshift tent in a Sheikh Ajdin neighborhood in Gaza City. Needless to mention that the eastern parts of Gaza Strip are still witnessing more cruel and brutal artillery shelling maintained by the Israeli occupation forces over the past couple of hours. Those attacks were intensified against the eastern part of Khan Yunis City, in addition to vast areas of Rafah City. And as we speak right now, by the way, we can hear those attacks that are still targeting the southern parts of Gaza Strip. They are still loud enough to be heard from the central area of Gaza Strip. And even when it comes to the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli attacks are still ongoing, whereas over the past couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes carried out another airstrike targeting Nusrat refugee camp, leaving multiple Palestinian casualties. And let me say that till this moment, the vast majority of those Palestinian casualties left behind the relentless Israeli attacks and bombings are still from women and its children. And as you know, those attacks are still ongoing following the massive attacks carried out by the Israeli occupation force and the massacres that were committed over the past 24 hours, basically in Khan Yunis City, after the Israeli warplanes pounded a multi-floor residential building, killing at least 25 Palestinian civilians of Al-Aqad family there. And in the meantime, as you know, more than 35 Palestinian civilians were slaughtered also in Al-Arqam school, taken shelter by the displaced people in a Tufah neighborhood in Gaza City, while 40 Palestinians are still presumed missing under the rubble. The current situation is extremely horrific and disastrous for the Palestinian people at all levels, particularly when it comes to the humanitarian conditions, which are still deteriorating severely for the Palestinian people. In this context, Philippe Lazzarini, the Commissioner General of the UNRWA, said that hunger and despair are still prevalent in all areas of Gaza Strip, while the Israeli occupation forces are still using those humanitarian supplies as a method of war against the Palestinian people. And as you know, the Israeli occupation forces are still tightening their grip against the Palestinian people. They are still preventing the flow of the humanitarian supplies to the people here for more than 35 consecutive days. And all Gaza crossings are still shut down and closed completely, which means, as you know, that the Palestinian people are facing a real starvation and famine here in Gaza Strip, and the people are still standing for long lines in order to obtain some amounts of the drinkable water. Needless to mention that the Israeli occupation forces on the ground are still expanding their military operations, particularly in Rafah City, the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City, in addition to Ash-Shajaiya neighborhood, which is still witnessing another recent ground offensive carried out by the Israeli occupation forces.
Thanks a lot, Moti Abu Mosaber, joining us from Deir al-Balah in the Gaza Strip. At least a dozen missiles hit a school in Gaza City, where many Palestinians had taken shelter. The strike killed at least 33 Palestinians, many of them women and children. Eyewitnesses say ambulances and medical crew were denied entry to the area where the massacre occurred. Our correspondent Qada Ibrahim reports on that.
Here I am in Dar al-Arqam sheltering school from the place of the very horrible massacre the Israeli war planes committed against the Palestinian civilians who were taking this place as a sheltering school. The Israeli missiles, 12 missiles, hit this building of the school, killed at least 33 Palestinians, many of them are children, women, and civilians, and wounded over 100 of the people who were taking this place as a shelter and who thought they are very safe in this place. In just a few hours, the Israeli occupation aggressively bombed the three sheltering schools with almost 12 American-made missiles. As people describe what happened here as an akin to an earthquake, the smoke is still rising from one of the buildings, and people are still looking and searching for the remains of their beloved ones and for what remains of their belongings. Here we are in front of one of the witnesses who saw the explosion and was in the place of the massacre.
I live here near. Suddenly, a huge explosion happened. I rushed to the place to find the bodies of the martyrs scattered across the vicinity of the school, and many of them were children. The ambulance were banned from entering the area, and they were threatened by the occupation army. After the first attack, they returned and carried out another attack. Many martyrs are still buried until now under the rubble of the building, and there are no available means of extracting them out.
Along with my husband and one-year-old child, we're preparing bread to eat, but suddenly we got buried under the rubble by the horrible explosion. We were pulled out by a miracle. This is unbelievable and should not be acceptable by the people of the world. We are dying here. The children were torn apart with no fault but being Palestinian in our own land.
With very long record of crimes, this crime is not the first and it is not surely the last. But what boldens this aggressive Israeli occupation army is the international silence towards these atrocities. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
The military wing of Hamas confirms the killing of one of its commanders in an Israeli airstrike on the Lebanese city of Sidon. The Al-Qassam Brigades hails Hassan Farhad for his prominent role in the resistance against Israel. The military wing of Hamas underlined that Israel's cowardly assassinations against Palestinian resistance fighters will never stop them from continuing on the path of perseverance and sacrifice for their sacred goal. In a separate statement, Lebanon's prime minister condemned the attack as a blatant assault on Lebanon's sovereignty. Nawaf Salam said Israel once again targeted peaceful civilians, calling for maximum pressure on the regime to end its aggression against Lebanon. Apart from Hassan Farhad himself, the Israeli airstrike on Sidon took the lives of his daughter and son. Israel has repeatedly violated the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon that came into effect in late November last year. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a fresh anti-U.S. operation, targeting several warships in the Red Sea for the second time within just 24 hours.
In response to the American aggression against our country, the naval, missile, and UAV forces of our armed forces targeted enemy warships in the Red Sea, led by the American aircraft carrier Truman, with a number of cruise missiles and drones in an engagement that was the second in the past 24 hours and continued for several hours. During the engagement, two air raids that the enemy was preparing to carry out against our country were thwarted.
Saadi stressed that Yemen cannot be broken or forced to surrender and will not abandon its religious, moral, and humanitarian duties toward the oppressed Palestinian people. The Yemeni nation's steadfast resistance persists even as U.S. attacks on Yemen escalate. Since March, U.S. military strikes have killed dozens of Yemeni civilians and wounded countless others. Yemen has vowed to continue its pro-Palestine and retaliatory military operations against Israel and the U.S.
For the last 10 years, we have been victorious. We are not in a state of defeat, and this is the promise by God to us. This is why we have full trust in God. We will continue our support for the Palestinian people and our battle against the Israeli enemy. We will also confront the U.S., which is supporting the Israeli enemy and protecting it.
Houthi said the U.S. resumed attacks on Yemenis to stop their support for Palestinians, but failed in its mission. He hailed Yemeni armed forces for shooting down 17 U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drones, which he described as a great and unique achievement. Houthi also said the U.S. aircraft carrier USS Harry Truman is constantly on the run in the face of Yemeni naval attacks. The Yemeni leader also warned Arab regimes against supporting the U.S. and Israel. He said the U.S. is responsible for Israeli crimes as it's providing the regime with all-out support, including through the supply of weaponry. Houthi stressed that Israeli crimes against Palestinians are aimed at forcibly displacing them. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti says the Israeli regime poses a grave danger for the entire region, and the Arab countries must pick up arms to face it.
I think this warning that Said Abdul Malik have sent to Arab nation, especially those who might get involved in attacking Yemen, and as well those countries that actually are helping the Zionist state of Israel to continue its attack against the Palestinian people. It doesn't matter if you are a friend or an enemy for the United States, they will target you. As we see what's happening in Syria, even though that the new government in Syria, we could say, is loyal to the Zionist state of Israel, because they haven't actually have formed anything against the Israeli regime. And as well, we've seen now that the Israeli regime and as well the United States is talking about Egypt, and they must withdraw their troops and their army tanks from Sinai, just south of Palestine. I think there is a huge plan that actually will take place. It will start with targeting countries if they are loyal to the United States. And that's why Said Abdul Malik is sending this clear warning. And he has asked the Arab regime and all Muslim nations to take up arms against the Zionist state of Israel, because this state is like a cancer.
Well, Syrians have taken to the streets in several cities across the Arab country to protest against Israeli attacks on their country. Protesters condemned Israeli attacks on Syrian soil and voiced solidarity with Palestinian people. The protests were held in Damascus, Daraa, and Aleppo. The protesters also mourned the victims of the latest Israeli strikes on Daraa, where several people were killed and multiple structures were destroyed. Residents have taken up arms and clashed with Israeli forces in Daraa after mosques called for a general mobilization. Since the fall of Syria's former government last December and the takeover by the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham militants, Israel has launched a spate of airstrikes to rob the country of its military capabilities. Kremlin says the question of Iran's nuclear program should be resolved politically and diplomatically, urging restraint on all sides.
In our opinion, the problem of Iran's nuclear dossier should be discussed and resolved only by political and diplomatic means. And of course, we believe that all sides should maintain absolute restraint here and focus on diplomatic efforts when discussing all the issues.
Peskov said Russia's restoration of bilateral relations with the United States will not affect ties with Tehran, and Iran remains its ally. Moscow has already offered to mediate between the two countries. The comments come after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to bomb Iran unless it comes to an agreement with Washington over its nuclear program. However, Tehran has repeatedly said it will not give in to pressure and is always open to negotiations based on mutual respect. Iran has condemned the UK and Germany for their instrumental use of human rights against the country. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said London and Berlin seek to impose their own political stances on Tehran. Ismail Baghaei made the remarks after the UN Human Rights Council adopted an anti-Iran resolution spearheaded by Germany and the UK. He dismissed the resolution as legally void due to the ill will of its drafters, its factually incorrect content, and reliance on unsubstantiated claims, that is, by anonymous sources. Baghaei stressed that the UK and Germany lack the moral standing to lecture others on human rights, given the two countries' support for Israel as it continues the genocide in Gaza. He said Iran spares no effort to safeguard human rights and fundamental freedoms. China has announced a slew of additional tariffs on and restrictions against U.S. goods in retaliation for the sweeping levies imposed by U.S. President Donald Trump. The Chinese Finance Ministry said it would impose tariffs of 34% on all U.S. goods starting next week. Beijing also announced it was adding several U.S. entities to an export control list while classifying others as an unreliable entity. The move comes after Donald Trump slapped a 34% additional tariff on all Chinese imports on Wednesday, on top of the 20% he had already imposed earlier this year, bringing the total new levies to 54%. The escalating trade war initiated by the U.S. president has fueled concerns about a potential global recession and triggered a downturn in the world's stock markets. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
As the Trump administration targets universities and teachers, educators in the United States are eyeing greener academic pastures overseas, and other nations are beginning to take notice. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The magazine The Week has covered the story and tells us more. The United States hosts many of the best educational and academic institutions on earth, and this has been instrumental in securing the country's status as a 21st century global superpower. These universities draw students, teachers, and researchers from around the world to help perpetuate the very academic superiority that appealed to them in the first place. Now, the White House has placed various universities and research institutions in its ideological crosshairs. The nation's reputation for academic excellence is in jeopardy. Prospective students and job seekers must contend with limited funds, the risk of deportation, or even worse. Suddenly, the United States' global educational appeal seems conspicuously less appealing. Meanwhile, other countries are noting the change, with some making plans to capitalize on America's waning collegiate pool. The president of Marseille University in France, Eric Burton, said, "We're witnessing a new brain drain." Marseille University has announced a new Safe Space for Science initiative to help American researchers continue their work at the university in southern France. So far, the project has attracted more than 50 American researchers who have applied to bring their expertise overseas, according to a university spokesperson. Universities worldwide have reported seeing an uptick in applications from U.S.-based researchers wary of the increasing uncertain climate of the Trump administration. Many institutions see an opportunity to attract new talent and reverse the steady migration of scientists to the United States in recent decades. According to Carl Bergstrom, a professor of biology at the University of Washington, there is a fire sale on American academics right now. Writing in the health and biomedical-focused publication ESTAT, Carl Bergstrom wrote about anxiety over the Trump administration's moves. It said this is so deep that it could ultimately undermine the country's enduring position as the world leader in biomedicine. The legally dubious detention of lawful U.S. resident students like Columbia University's PhD candidate Mahmoud Khalil is sure to have a chilling effect, not only on foreign-born academics already studying at American universities, but on the desire of others to go there in the future. Concern from members of the academic community is not limited to individual domestic employment prospects, but includes the long-term viability of their research itself. According to the New York Times, the prospect of losing a generation of both science and scientists is something that we cannot recover from, according to the Pasteur Institute president, Yasmin Belkade, a recently relocated former official at the National Institute of Health in the United States. The Trump administration's moves call into question whole swathes of research, not simply in America, but globally, thanks to international partnerships, French Education Minister Philippe Baptiste said in the same article. A number of countries are considering the situation in the United States an opportunity for their own academic and research institutions. Canadian universities can be an entryway for a flood of talent fleeing American academia. China, too, has begun welcoming PhD refugees from the United States by offering new academic pathways. According to the Hong Kong South China Morning Post, America's academic upheaval is a once-in-a-century brain gain opportunity for Australia as well, according to Daniel Cave, a senior analyst for the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Jonathan Zimmerman, a professor of history of education at the University of Pennsylvania, speaking to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC, said, "Historically, brain drain migration has benefited the United States. But there is now a real danger that as a result of the Trump administration's policies, the brain drain is going to start going in the opposite direction." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Trump administration is cutting funding while specifically targeting institutions like Columbia University in New York. No wonder American academics are opting out. In 6 weeks, the Trump administration's rapid rescheduled disassembly of American science has been as sharp and deep as the trashing of U.S.'s alliances and goodwill. Earth science, weather forecasting and early warning systems, medical research, including cancer research, NASA, academic grants more broadly have been cut, paused, and subject to review for a long list of banned words, including such contentious terms as political and women. This has caused universities across the United States to reduce their intake of PhD students, medical students, and other graduate students, introduce hiring freezes, and even rescind some offers of admission. More than 12,500 U.S. citizens currently in other countries on Fulbright research grants recently had their funding paused, along with 7,400 foreign scholars currently hosted in the United States, leaving them financially stranded. And when it came to one foreign academic visiting the United States, detaining them and refusing them entry. Even more worryingly, the administration is specifically targeting some universities, including pulling $400 million in funding from Columbia University in New York and $800 million from Johns Hopkins University, forcing it to lay off 2,000 people. Furthermore, the legally dubious arrest and detention of Mahmoud Khalil and the cancelling of his green card is sure to have a chilling effect on foreign students and researchers already in the United States and on the desire of others to go there in the future. As Christina Pagel, A German-British professor at University College London writes, "This isn't chaos. Instead, the attacks on research appear to follow a three-pronged objective: to forcibly align science with state ideology, undermine academic independence and suppress dissent, and maintain geopolitical and economic goals." The Saturn V rockets that took US astronauts to space and eventually the moon in the 1960s owed their existence to Operation Paperclip, which brought 1,500 former Nazi scientists, such as Wernher von Braun, the former director of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, to the United States. In the week after Donald Trump's election, many are wondering whether the German philosopher Jürgen Habermas may inadvertently get his wish of a Europe that unified through opposition to the United States, and suggested that Europe position itself to reverse the decades-long transatlantic brain drain by welcoming highly educated American researchers and scientists who were sure to find themselves under attack. This time, there is no moral quandary about it, no Nazi past to ignore, only as much advantage to be gained as can be in a world where the European Union must hold the ground for liberal democratic society, joined by Canada to the west and Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand to the east. To some extent, European Union governments and institutions are already picking up on the opportunity. For example, on 7th of March this year, the University of Marseille in southern France announced Safe Place for Science, a three-year, 15 million euro program to bring 15 American scientists working in climate, health, and astrophysics to its campus. According to a Marseille University spokesperson, more than 60 applications have been received, 30 of them coming within the first 24 hours. The university indicated that it has been in contact with other universities and the French government about expanding scientific asylum on both a national and European level, and to help coordinate welcoming and relocating different researchers.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani.
We know that Ali had many characteristics that shined very bright. The reality is all of these characteristics at the end of the day came down to the worship of Ali and the relationship that he had built with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So you find Ali ibn Abi Talib constantly made time for his worship. When he was taking the seeds and the kernels of the dates to plant them so that they would turn into palm trees, so that he could grant these away as charity, the narration says every time he planted one of them, turakat salat. This is part of his lifestyle. At night, they say, in his house, the sixth imam says, in his house, he had a special place of worship for himself. And when he was taking care of the kids, does that ring a bell for anyone? When he was taking care of the kids as the father in the house, he would bring the little kids with him. They would sleep there and he would do his worship there. It was built into his life. What is the lesson for you and I? The lesson for you and I is that if you see the beauty of the character of Ali, you cannot take that beauty without his worship. And you and I have to learn to make time for worship. You can't be as brave as Ali was without the salats. You can't be as charismatic as he was, as compassionate as he was, without the worship. You and I, and this is a trend in our communities and in our younger generation, they look at Ali and they praise him and they think he's wonderful, yes? They want everything Ali had and they aspire to everything that Ali had, but they forget about the foundation that Ali built. This is his foundation. You build this foundation, you set your ego aside, then you will become a source of all goodness and of all khair. And out of all of these acts of worship that you find Ahl Bayt emphasize for us, maybe none of them they emphasize as much as they emphasize Salat. And hence you find in the words of Ali, he keeps going back to Salat, Salat, Salat. Do you pray? Do you do your Salat? For them, their Salat was on a different level. For you and I, at the very least, we can't be cutting corners on obligations. We can't be sitting there and saying, yes, now it's difficult, I can't do this one today. No, no, that's not how it works. This is your foundation. So Ali is writing to Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr to send him to be in charge of Egypt. He's going to become his governor. Now when you're the governor, what do? You deal with people's taxes, you deal with their affairs, you do all of this kind of stuff. And in this letter that he's writing to Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, and all of the, you know, advice that he's giving to him, then he turns to him and he says this. He says, "Wandur ila salatik." You're going to be the governor, you better pray a good prayer. Your salat needs to be top-notch. Because people will be following you, people look at you, you're the standard, you have to do your salat properly. And then he continues and he says, "Huh, and your wudu should better be a good wudu too." And he said, your wudu is a big part of your faith. Wudu is the preparation for salat. And the imam says, this is a big part of your faith. Then he said, when you go to your ruku and sajda, you better do a good job with your ruku and sajda. And then he said this, and this is a lesson for you and I. He said, faj'al kullu shay'in, and make everything else, and know that everything else taba'un li salatika. Everything else follows your salat. Every other act of worship follows salat. He said, the one who messes up on his salat, he will mess up on other things even greater, even bigger. Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr is a governor. In some ways, he's a politician. And Ali says, oh, you better be careful how you pray. People are going to look at you. And this is why narrations tell us of the pros of someone who is a person who's constantly acquainted with salat, and the negativities of the one who does a poor job with his salat. If I don't pray consistently, this is my sign to start doing so. If I pray consistently, then this is my sign to start perfecting my salat. Yes? There's salat. You can do salat in whichever way you want. The Prophet said, two people from my ummah, they stand for salat. The difference between them is like the difference between the earth and the skies. This one, when he prays, God knows what's happening in his heart. He's paying attention to God 24/7. This one, when he prays, no. He said, Allahu Akbar, what do we have for iftar? It's a big difference between the two. By the way, if you're thinking that, I don't blame you. It's a big difference between the two. So on the pros, Ali said this, and this is another big lesson for you and I. He said, listen, salat is so important. It has that ability that when you are disconnected in your relationship with God, to quickly connect you again. You know what he's talking about? He's talking about that feeling you get in your stomach, yes, when you did something wrong. When you commit a sin, yes, and afterwards you come back and you know what you did is wrong. And you feel this hollowness inside of you because you know what you did. And you know your relationship with God has been severed. And what did Ali say? Ali said, listen, if you do a couple things, you're almost back on track. Don't worry about it. He said, when you commit a sin, if you come after it, number one, of course, tawbah. There's no doubt about that. Number one. And he said, but then if you add some salat afterwards, if you add a 2 rakat salat afterwards, you're really back on track now. You're getting a lot better. You're plugging back into that relationship again. This is the power of salat. He said, rak'atan, 2 rakas. And hence, when he used to see people doing a poor job with their salat, and just Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, like we do, he He looked at them and he told this man who was praying like this, Naqara ka naqril qurab, he was pecking like the pecking of a crow. He said, listen, how long have you been praying like this? And this man said, I've always been praying like this. And he said, listen, you're missing out. He said, the person who steals the most, the greatest thief, is the one who steals salat from his own life. He said, this is the greatest thief. Huh? He said, don't pray like this. This is not how the Prophet taught us to pray. And in all of this prayer, there's one moment that is the absolute peak. It is the pinnacle. It's the most important part of your whole salat, and that is your sajda. And this is why you find narration after narration after narration that Ahl Bayt taught us that when you pray, prolong your sajda a little bit. Stay in sajda a little bit. This is the closest you are to God. This is when Shaitan looks at you and regrets things the most, because he was asked to do the same sajda and he never did it. And hence when he sees you in sajda and you prolong this sajda, this distances you the most from Shaitan. Hence you find in the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt, a sajda and a long sajda, a prolonged sajda, was always part of their seerah. Because Ali knows, when I prolong this sajda, if I'm really doing a good job with it, then the fruits of this spirituality will show up through his justice and compassion and hundreds of other virtues that you and I cannot count. This is where he builds the foundation. So his companion says, I entered into his house. I wanted to tell him something. I saw him, he's praying. I approached him. He pointed to me with his hands. So I'm praying. Ended his salat. I thought, great. Now he ended his salat. Then he went to sajda. This is the sajda after salat. And he stayed in sajda. And I said, فَوَاللَّهِ نَامْ. I'm sure he's asleep. This is how long he was in sajda. And the narration says, I went with the fourth imam, Imam al-Sajjad, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. He says, I went with the fourth imam and I saw him praying. And then he went to sajda and he stayed in sajda and he started to say adhkar and tasbih and tasbih. It reached the point where I saw everything around us is saying tasbih with us. This is the sajda of the Ahlul Bayt. And let this be what you take away from tonight. Let sajda be a part of your life. It doesn't even have to be a part of your salat. If it's part of your salat, you prolong it. If it's not even part of your salat, then what will you do? You will do this as a separate sajda. How many narrations do we have from Ahlul Bayt? They were walking, all of a sudden do sajda. But you're not praying right now. It's my obedience to God. It's my thankfulness to God. The nights of Qadr we are going through, maybe sometimes you just put your head down on the dirt, you do sajda, and just talk to God, and just think of what you want from Him, and all of this. And this is a strong way to build your relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this relationship will then become the foundation for all of the other virtues that you and I are after.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir. روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
The United States is one of the countries in the world, according to an international watch list, that is facing a rapid decline in civic freedoms. The Civicus Monitor watch list is a global civil rights watchdog and issues lists every year of countries that it believes are currently experiencing a rapid decline in civic freedoms. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. The United States has been added to the Civicus Monitor watch list, which identifies countries that the global civil rights watchdog believes are currently experiencing a rapid decline in civic freedoms. Civicus, an international non-profit organization dedicated to strengthening citizen action and civil society around the world, announced the inclusion of the United States on the nonprofit's first watch list of 2025 on Monday, 10th of March, alongside the Democratic Republic of Congo, Italy, Pakistan, and Serbia. The watch list is part of the Civicus Monitor, which tracks developments in civic freedoms across 198 countries. Other countries that have previously been featured on the watch list in recent years include Zimbabwe, Argentina, El Salvador, and United Arab Emirates. Mandeep Tiwana, co-secretary general of Civicus, said that the watch list looks at countries where we remain concerned about deteriorating civic space conditions in relation to freedoms of peaceful assembly, peaceful association, and expression. The website states the selection process incorporates insights and data from Civicus's global network of research partners and data. The decision to add the United States of America to the first 2025 watch list was made in response to what the group described as the Trump administration's assault on democratic norms and global cooperation. Continue with The Guardian's coverage of this news story. In the news release announcing the U.S.'s addition, the organization cited recent actions taken by the Trump administration that they argue will likely severely impact constitutional freedoms of peaceful assembly, peaceful expression, and association. The group cited several of the Trump administration's actions, such as mass termination of federal employees, the appointment of Trump loyalists in key government positions, the withdrawal from international efforts such as the World Health Organization, WHO, and the UN Human Rights Council, the freezing of federal and foreign aid, and the attempted dismantling of U.S. aid. The organization warned that these decisions will likely impact civic freedoms and reverse hard-won human rights gains around the world. The group also pointed to the administration's crackdown on pro-Palestinian protesters and the Trump administration's unprecedented decision to control media access to presidential briefings, among others. Civicus described Trump's actions since taking office as an unparalleled attack on the rule of law, not seen since the days of Joseph McCarthy in the 20th century, stating that these movements erode the checks and balances essential to democracy. Mandeep Tiwana said restrictive executive orders, unjustifiable institutional cutbacks, and intimidation tactics through threatening pronouncements by senior officials in the administration are creating an atmosphere to chill democratic dissent, a cherished American ideal. In addition to the watch list, the Civicus Monitor classifies the state of civic space in countries using five ratings, open, narrowed, obstructed, repressed, and closed. Currently, the U.S. has a narrowed rating, which it also had during the Biden administration, meaning that while citizens can exercise their civic freedom, such as rights to association, peaceful assembly, and expression, occasional violations occur. Mandeep Tiwana said for part of Trump's first term in office, the U.S. had been categorized as obstructed due to the administration's response to the Black Lives Matter movement and restrictive state laws that were enacted limiting the rights of environmental justice protesters and other actions. Tiwana said under Joe Biden, the classification went back to narrowed, but as of Monday, the 10th of March, the United States has been placed on the watch list as the group says it sees significant deterioration in civic freedoms occurring in America. Mandeep Tiwana noted that the United States is again seemingly headed towards the obstructed category. While the Trump administration often says they support fundamental freedoms and individual rights like free speech, Mandeep Tiwana, co-secretary general of Civicus, believes the administration seems to be wanting to support these only for people who they see as agreeing with them. Tiwana added, historically, the United States has been considered the so-called beacon of democracy and defense of fundamental freedoms. It was an important pillar of U.S. foreign policy, even though it was imperfect, both domestically and how the U.S. promoted it abroad. But Mandeep Tiwana believes that the recent actions and statements made by the Trump administration could empower authoritarian regimes around the world, undermine constitutional principles, and embolden those who want to accumulate power and increase their wealth and their ability to stay in power for as long as possible. Tiwana said that he and the organization want to draw attention to the fact that those in power in the United States are, in his view, engaging in zero-sum policies game. That is, eroding constitutional principles and, frankly, engaging in anti-American behavior. Tiwana added, "We urge the United States to uphold the rule of law and respect constitutional and international human rights norms." Following his inauguration on 20th of January this year, Donald Trump has issued at least 125 executive orders, dismantling federal policies with profound implications for human rights and the rule of law. Some of these executive orders have eliminated federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, falsely framing them as discriminatory, and have introduced measures targeting undocumented migrants and non-conforming people. Since mid-January this year, many civil society organizations, both in the United States and abroad, have been forced to terminate or scale back their essential human rights and humanitarian programs due to growing uncertainty caused by the arbitrary suspension of foreign aid and a broad freeze on federal funding. The lack of clear guidelines has sparked legal challenges at the national level. The Trump administration has taken steps to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, a decades-old institution, and laid off thousands of its employees. It has also withdrawn from the World Health Organization, WHO, as well as the United Nations Human Rights Council. The Trump administration has also exited the Paris Climate Accord, rejecting the Agenda 2030 and the Sustainable Development Goals, and announced sanctions on the International Criminal Court, the ICC, at The Hague in Netherlands. The Trump administration has also tried to target ICC's personnel, as well as individuals and entities that cooperate with the ICC. These actions could further undermine global efforts for climate justice, for human rights, and for civic freedoms. have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 26, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of university students and academic personalities on the 24th day of month of Ramadan. Western colonial policies have not stopped working. That neo-colonial policy is still in place and is working. Their think tanks, as they themselves put it, are thinking. They allocate budgets to this and work on our universities. Therefore, we must be concerned because the challenge is still ongoing. You should compare the influence that our universities exert over the country and its affairs with the influence that 150,000 students in the beginning of the revolution exerted. Well, the former's influence is much more. Therefore, if the enemy can do sabotage work inside universities, its outcomes, harms, and damages will be several times more than the early revolution days. This is because universities are larger and vast. They have a lot of youth in them. They have active speakers, artists, and the like. Therefore, we must be concerned about this. What should we be concerned about? What issue and matter requires that academic officials and you students be concerned about it? In my opinion, the issue is primarily the elimination of ideology and ideals in universities. What we must primarily be concerned and worried about is this. We must think about it. everyone must do so, including academic managers and activists such as university professors, researchers, U students, and the officials of the country. Today, in many statements that are published in newspapers and in cyberspace, you hear that the issue of destroying ideology is brought up as a necessary task. This is synonymous with the elimination of identity. Ideology is the philosophy, values, and identity of a nation. Today, the qibla of such individuals is the US, and the Americans themselves highlight and rely on American values. American values are an ideology in themselves, but such individuals are not prepared to learn this from the US. When it is said that the elimination of ideology is necessary in the country, this means that the intellectual identity of society, whose important manifestation is universities and students, has to be destroyed. The elimination of identity means this.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.